coming to this theater soon, The Beast of Yucca Flats. Filmed on the burning hot sands by Yucca Flats. See terror, panic, murder. See the Cardoza and Francis production of The Beast of Yucca Flats. See a man turn killer. See a woman ravaged. See one of the most exciting movies ever made. See The Beast of Yucca Flats. A killer on the loose. Death sweeps across the desert. Panic. A bloodthirsty killer stalks a moonlit desert. See The Beast of Yucca Flats.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age by John Woolley, Dan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you very much, Michael Price, Michael H. Price, the auteur behind Comics from the Gone World, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on, and my pal and my collaborator on a great number of things. Michael, it's great to be doing this again, and Joey, our producer, says that we need to do a synopsis, just kind of start out, just in case people might not have seen the film we're discussing tonight, Beast of Yucca.
How do we synopsize The Beast of Yucca Flats?
Well, let me try and do a short one, and you can annotate it if you'd like.
We will pull this one out if it kills us all.
Tor Johnson is a Russian scientist who has double-crossed the Russians. He's escaping in the desert from the Russians, and then there's an atomic bomb blast, and he turns into the Beast of Yucca Flats. There's also some stuff about a couple of, policemen. There's a low-speed car chase.
Mr. Jaworski, get in the car.
Rangers, I think they are, yes.
Rangers, that's correct.
And by golly, there is a very thrilling car chase. is that overcranked camera, or are they just moving very slowly?
The whole film seems to move pretty slowly, and you know that it does start off with a murder, which is the quietest murder I think in cinema history.
Well, it's a silent film.
Well, it just about is, isn't it? I mean, they didn't have any synchronized sound at all in Yucca Flats.
The overdubbing, yeah.
It was like watching a Doris Wishman film without the skin, or maybe there was skin, we just didn't see it. But
they shot the thing without sound, MOS, which stands for without sound.
Without sound, right.
And went back in and dubbed in some really over-emphatic music, like dramatic, menacing orchestral stings where you don't need one.
Right, right.
And the strangest thing was when people talk, they seem to always have their backs to the camera, so you really can't tell who's talking.
That's exactly right.
Of course, nobody's talking at all. You got some bored voiceover actor sitting there before a microphone in a studio pretending to be interested.
Right, exactly.
So there's not a lot of urgency about the developments in Yucca Flats.
And it has we don't want to be a complete spoiler, so we'll just say it has one of the most interesting uses of a bunny rabbit ever in the cinema. Wouldn't you?
I, uh, Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. It's like, yeah, that's a very unconventional choice. If you got to have a wild animal, and I'm sure it's a tame rabbit, but what's it doing there?
Well, and you could ask that for some of the narration, too. What's it doing there?
Boys from the city, not yet caught in the whirlwind of progress, feed soda pop to the thirsty pigs.
Coleman Francis is pretty much the auteur behind this. And before we get into it, Michael, if you don't mind, we might go into just a little bit of background on the two people who made this, Anthony Cardoza and Coleman Francis. Now, of course, with Tor Johnson, also with Conrad Brooks, who is an actor seen in the airport footage.
Yes, and an Ed Wood veteran to carry on the continuity from an earlier episode of this program.
That's right. And Anthony Cardoza was also an Ed Wood cohort and was one of the producers on Night of the Ghouls and did some stuff. I think had some money involved in some of Ed Wood's pictures. You know,
he put up cash, yes.
Yeah, I think he was one of those guys. You know, Coleman Francis had a real legitimate Hollywood career.
Yes, you know, for a guy who basically looked like a grimmer version of Curly Howard.
He does, and you know, they kind of exploit in Mystery Science Theater. I believe that was the film named Red Zone Cuba. Is that the name of the film that they?
I believe that's right.
That they took on in that series.
It smells like Coleman Francis in here.
And a lot of the humor comes out of the fact that Coleman Francis looks an awful lot like Curly. But, you know, he was in Hollywood and always doing small parts, but he was also, you know, he's in This Island Earth. He's in Commando Cody.
And there's
that poignant story that I think was I first read in Research 10, the Incredibly Strange Films book, where Ray Dennis Steckler talks about rapping on, I believe the film was Body Heat, his detective's show, and he and Ron Haydock come out of a restaurant in Hollywood. And they look over in the gutter, and there's a drunk lying there, and says, "Well, that looks." Ray Dennis Steckler says, "That looks like Coleman Francis." Sure enough, it was, and he said, "You know," Ed goes over and talks to him, and Coleman Francis, "I'm just looking for a job," you know. Ray Dennis Steckler said, "Give him $20," and Steckler says, "Well, yeah, this is an advance on your job." He, even though they'd finished the film, he shows up the next day to shoot another piece of footage for the film with Ed Wood. With Ray Dennis Steckler, just made it up. And he shows up, and he's bought a sport coat from a resale store with some of the $20, and he's there, and he's ready to go, and they improvise a scene, which if you've seen Body Heat, that's one of the really nice scenes in Body Heat.
It plays very, yes, exactly. Let's see, that intrigue picture, I think, was called Night Train to Mundo Fini.
Was it Night Train to Mundo Fini?
Night Train to Mundo Fini, yeah. I was just flashing on that. And, of course, there's another one of those, is this incoherent and worthless, or is this honest and valuable?
And it's somewhere in between, isn't it?
Kind of. It's got too many artistic touches to be dismissed as hack work. Hack work, I think of as a lot of big studios B movies, where they were cranked out to meet a quota. These guys weren't meeting quotas; they were speaking from their souls, however incoherent the voice.
Exactly, and you know we've talked about this many times in the past, Michael. But there's that whole notion of camp, of intentional camp versus unintentional camp.
Mm-hmm.
Say so much of of the input of the Killer Tomatoes type thing and the Lloyd Kaufman stuff, the trauma stuff, which was supposed to be, it was made to be bad.
So that's the biggest turn off I can see in a movie.
Essentially, what people are saying when they talk about anti-genius is that mistakes that a regular hack will occasionally make the right choice, but a true anti-genius, if you follow this line of thinking, will always make the wrong choice. Will always steer for the rocks. And a lot of steering for the rocks in this picture.
Yes. It's somebody along the line. One of the Hollywood fringe dwellers that was part of this community must have seen Tor Johnson in what, the Unearthly Bride of the Monster, whatever, and said, "Hey, that guy looks like Nikita Khrushchev." And I think the resemblance in Beast of Yucca Flats, although he plays a scientist and not a politician, I think that resemblance was calculated.
How interesting. I never thought about that.
It's like, yes, he's a Russian. Well, actually, Johnson was Swedish, but he had the rotund physique, and he wasn't chubby. This guy was a very healthy, well-modulated wrestler. So he actually had the formidable physical presence to match the book.
Right.
And with that shaved head, with that rather intense stare that he could generate, the guy looks like Khrushchev.
You know, I never thought about that. He looks like Khrushchev if Khrushchev had been a wrestler. And that's really what you got. And I'll bet you, Michael, it was Anthony Cardoza that was the one who brought Tor aboard, because he'd been associated with him with Night of the Ghouls and some of that other stuff.
Right.
And, you know, and they all hung out together. He hung out with Ed, and Cardoza was in that group. And I'll bet you it was Cardoza that did that, that brought him aboard. And I think that's a really good, or if Nikita Khrushchev could have, like, eaten an entire deer.
Joseph Jaworski, respected scientist, now a fiend, prowling the wastelands, a prehistoric beast in the nuclear age. Kill. Kill just to be killing.
Michael, you know, there are a couple of places where there could be some brief nudity. And, you know, you've probably heard, too, that there was, at one point, there was an uncensored version, and there was some nudity, which would have to be either at the beginning when the girl is coming out of the shower, or when the partner leaves his girlfriend there. But what would be the circumstances under which you would even have nudity? Would one brief little bit of nudity have been okay to... Would have qualified it to be shown at grindhouses and stuff?
Oh yeah, sure. There were a lot of bait and switches like that.
I guess that's probably true. And if people would sit through an entire film, it's hard for people to realize nowadays. But people would sit through an entire very boring film to see a little glimpse of an unclothed breast, wouldn't they? You know, you think about it, that's really true.
That's exactly right, and I suspect not too many prints went out. I figure most prints went out to the drive-ins.
Probably so, or the grindhouses, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And, I'm not really sure what kind of distribution it got. It wasn't distributed by any of the regular, I mean, obviously it was states' rights of some sort.
DIY.
Yeah.
This was not a film that had any kind of formal distribution. It did have some reissues, and in fact, what you were talking about, grindhouses. One of the alternate titles I show on the darn thing is "Girl Madness."
Girl Madness. Well, then, which, you know, maybe they did shoot a little bit of nude. Partially
they must have, because the where you would expect that element to show up, there are some very awkward cuts.
That's true.
At least in the prints that I've seen. And of course, when that played brand new, I was late grade school, early junior high school, and couldn't have gotten near one of those grindhouses.
Right.
Not without the manager informing my family.
Even in your uncle's, your uncle, for the listeners, I don't know if you've ever referenced your uncle's theater before. Of course, I know that your uncle was a theater man, and you met William Cass and a lot of the people through your uncle.
Oh, yeah.
Did your uncle have a series of theaters or what down in Texas?
He managed the interstate circuit theaters for a lot of West Texas, primarily based at Amarillo, but his interests ranged on down into Dallas, Fort Worth, and a surrounding area, Lubbock, what have you. And some of those beautiful interstates. In fact, he was responsible for building the pilot for the first suburban theater. Movie theaters in larger cities were all downtown.
Right.
And the Esquire Theater in Amarillo became the pilot, the flagship for that new wave of suburban theaters, which led to such well-known venues today as the Inwood in Dallas, the Granada in Dallas, a number of theaters that wouldn't have existed if that pilot in Amarillo hadn't worked so well. But he had three flagship theaters in his home base city. One was for the B movies, one was for the top of the line big studio pictures, and one was for the foreign, the more experimental. Today we'd call them indies.
And where would Tor have played?
Tor would have played at one of the drive-in theaters.
He would have been a drive-in. And you think then that Coleman Francis, Anthony Cardoza, that they roadshowed the picture, or they just made their own deals with the with the exchanges, or how do you think
they went? They went around the country as their mentors in this racket would have done.
Okay, like the 40 Thieves and Dave Friedman.
40 Thieves, Kroger Friedman, Land, the Sonics.
Mm-hmm.
As those roadshow carny guys. Basically, they were carnies peddling movies.
And they had a second feature with this, which I think, if memory serves, was some sort of a juvenile delinquent movie. I should check that. I can't remember. But
I'm not placing
feature.
It offhand, but that hardly means anything.
Yeah, and... So
I'm
would have taken
sifting through this stack of paper looking for a distribution company, and I don't find one.
Really?
That is so peculiar.
That is very odd.
But, the film, for a film that got so much hype in the primary magazine of the monster movie fans, that is Ackerman's Famous Monsters, it was very hard to find.
That's true. That's true.
And, of course, Ackerman's interests were entirely conflict of interest.
He never really met a conflict of interest
he
didn't like, Forey, God bless him. We love Forey, but he did use the magazine to hype a lot of his clients.
To hype a lot of his clients. It's like, is this journalism or is this marketing? Well, not a lot of journalism went on in Famous Monsters, despite some really strained attempts at writing.
That's true.
The main reason I was interested in the darn thing was for the photographs.
Of course, and I think that's what most of us were exactly the same way. But if you get to, and there's some striking photographs you mentioned earlier, Tor Johnson's resemblance to Khrushchev, which I had not thought of before. And by the way, our producer, Joey, really thinks that was a sterling observation on your part.
I think in 1961, the year of the movie, Khrushchev was like the man you love to hate.
Mm-hmm, sure. He was kind of like a pro wrestler, only the head.
He was probably more world theater posturing on his part than it was actual menace, because we all know today the Cold War was actually a series of postures,
sure.
Implied threats that were designed to keep people divided politically. The greater insight from hindsight is that Russia and the United States aren't going to mess with each other to the degree a lot of people are afraid of because of the reality of mutually assured destruction.
Right, right.
That's what you have. That's what you have politically speaking and strategically speaking when you have antagonists that both represent highly civilized cultures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they got too much to lose to drop the big one.
So how has this played out in Beast of Yucca Flats, this whole, because it is. I mean, this Beast of Yucca Flats is about what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly it is, and it's about the Cold War, and I think it is politically, you know, it's so darn silly that it's harmless, but I think the intent was to generate anti-Soviet sentiment.
Well, I think it's Coleman Francis's Citizen Kane is what I think.
Man's inhumanity to man.
That he was able to get, you know, he's a guy, this film seems to have like a lot of fascinating Z pictures. Some people figured it out. We've talked about Edgar Ulmer. They figured out that you could say something and do something pretty artistic and even meaningful if you, for PRC, in Ulmer's case, if you could do it for no money whatsoever. And, you know, Corman and his nurse pictures and his cheerleader pictures realized that he could have all sorts of polemic in those films if he just had some starlet pop or top about every 10 pages of script.
That's precisely what Corman did, and his work is therefore very subversive. Coleman Francis, well, Yucca Flats in this case, Coleman Francis's approach is entirely reactionary. He introduces a Russian scientist, Tor Johnson,
right,
who looks a whole lot like Nikita Khrushchev, trying to defect, chased by the KGB, and of course, every red-blooded American in 1961 pretty well had been convinced that those doggone Soviets were no damn good at all.
Right.
And so even the ones who try to defect are going to become monsters.
Okay.
And, yeah, Corman, on the other hand, took a very, well, he took a very, I don't know how enlightened his pictures are, but they certainly are thought-provoking.
That's right. Yeah, they're very thought-provoking. And, you know, this picture, so, like, does the rabbit, without giving anything away, does the rabbit represent peace, you think, in this? Yeah, that would tie it up.
You're talking
nicely
about the final shot, yes, which involves a rabbit and a feral rabbit, I would suppose. It's a very strange, dreamlike film, a very dreamlike film from beginning to end. And that ending, not to give anything away, but that ending is like, wait a minute, am I dreaming?
It is dream logic, which happens a lot of times in films like this.
It's free association.
Right. And it's somebody somewhere thought it was a good idea on some level.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing that fascinates me. And, you know, if I can go back just and look at it from a practical point of view, the press book I have doesn't really, and I'm going to have to look this up, but I don't think it has a distributor either on it, but it does have, it's a double bill, and it's a press book, but it's a very cheap looking press book, almost like it's typed, you know, and mimeographed or something, but there's two films on it, and I think one is a juvenile delinquent film, perhaps with religious overtones, if I'm not mistaken. What I'm wondering is if Coleman Francis, being the veteran that he was, and Cardoza also being a veteran of the B-movies, I wonder if they looked, because, you know, one of Sam Arkoff and James Nicholson's great things when they started AIP was they looked at the studios, the studio model that had come along before the antitrust suit, when the studios could block book, and so you had an A picture and a B picture, which, of course, is where...
And when studios, during various stages between the antitrust rushes, some of the studios actually owned chains of theaters.
Absolutely, and that was forbidden in the late 40s when the antitrust thing came down as well.
Right.
So left a big bunch of space in theaters for new product. I think Arkoff and Nicholson's great idea, one of them, was instead of sending an A picture and a B picture out on a double feature, because people had grown used to double features, they sent out two B pictures.
And
I'm just kind of wondering if that wasn't the idea that Cardoza and Coleman Francis copped was the idea of send out two Z pictures.
Gorman got the idea from RKO, which started the double bill reissues of its B pictures. Right. You know, you'd have like the reissue of Mighty Joe Young in the early 50s coupled with one of the Val Lewton pictures.
Right, right.
And Gorman as much as acknowledged that influence, but he turned it into something entirely different by doing brand new pictures.
And do you think it was Corman or it was Arkoff and Nicholson that did that?
I think it was Corman who was generating product so relentlessly that they kept saying, what are we going to do with all this stuff?
And he had to jump around and jump to Allied Artists and even have film group, have his own group.
Yes, exactly. Corman was so prolific that the studio we think of as the Corman Studio, American International, really couldn't handle it.
That's right.
And that's why Film Group, which was his own company, his umbrella company, and the Allied Artists connection. Some of the best Cormans are actually from Allied Artists.
I'm a sucker for the Film Group ones, though, Michael. Of course, it was Gene Corman Film. I love Beast from Haunted Cave. You know, I love the original, of course, Little Shop of Horrors, which was a Film Group. Buckle Blood, I guess, was AIP, wasn't it? But
I believe so, but Corman retained that Film Group identity just as Herman Cohen, his contemporary associated with AIP, just as Cohen maintained his own studio.
Right.
Basically within the studio, but of course it was the Herman Cohen connection that basically proved to Warner Brothers and Hammer Studios, Hammer Films in England, that you could do Anglo-American pictures.
Mm-hmm. Which we're going to be dealing with.
Profit.
Yeah. Now, we're going to deal with that next, aren't we? I think we're going to do one of those Anglo-American pictures next in our next podcast. I think it's one that you've come up with. So,
Horrors of the Black Museum. Story for another day.
That is a story for another day. But you know, you wonder where did you see Beast? I mean, who picked it up? Was it picked up on a television package? Is that how most of the Monster Kids saw it? I mean, you can see it anywhere.
I know I saw it when I was a kid, and my response to it at the time was something along the lines of "Phooey."
Well, you said "Phooey" a lot when you were a kid, is my guess.
but I did watch the darn thing, and I took notes.
Yeah,
I've still got the notes, and they come in real handy.
They do.
A small wonder a kid of that particular generation would look at Yucca Flats after having been spoiled by, say, the Unearthly or the Black Sleep, mm-hmm. and responded, "Phooey."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, I do think that there are echoes, that the guys are putting echoes of other influences that were around at that time in there. I think there's Jack Webb-style dialogue.
It's more Lowell Thomas-style dialogue, I think, John. The stern, emphatic newsman of times gone by.
That's true.
The only passion, really, I mean, Tor's walking through it, bless his heart. The only real passion I get out of Yucca Flats is that the narrator seems to think this is very serious business.
Flag on the Moon. How did it get there? Secret data. Pictures of the moon. Secret data. Never before outside the Kremlin. Man's first rocket to the moon.
Well, whoever wrote the narration seems to think it's serious business, but it's the narration is of Glenn or Glenda quality, I think. And, you know, everybody talks about Flag on the Moon, but honestly, my favorite piece of dialogue monologue, and it is, nothing bothers some people, not even flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't really even deconstruct that.
You know, fine. I was spoiled to the RKO Val Lewton pictures, the Universal Gothics, the usual mm-hmm. class act pictures, and I was also very fond of those Roger Corman drive-in movies. Some of which I saw at the drive-ins when new, some of which were soon thereafter on TV, and I at 12 or 13 years old I could get as much value out of Attack of the Crab Monsters as I could out of Son of Frankenstein.
Absolutely, I agree. And it all came at us. That's something I think people who didn't grow up then, and I know if you're not of baby boomer age and you're listening to this, you're probably saying, well, here they go again. You know, it's like one of those baby boomer deals and how wonderful it was. But honestly, that whole Monster Kid thing, all of that stuff just swirled together.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, nostalgia is a crock.
Yeah, that's right.
I prefer to remember things fondly, but to seek out new, sometimes new cheap thrills, sometimes new intellectual stimulus, sometimes just plain entertainment value, and always reserve the right to go backtrack mm-hmm. and look at what you liked when it was new, when you were, say, 13, 20, 30, whatever, and see how well it holds up.
Right.
And frequently it doesn't hold up worth a doggone. I do know that I have a greater interest in Coleman Francis and the mm-hmm. Beast of Yucca Flats today than I did when I was, in junior high school.
Exactly, because sometimes it does. Sometimes you can reach back there in the past and pull something out and look at it again. And it looks mm-hmm. like a gem instead of, a cow flop.
And if it holds up, more power to it. And if it doesn't, well, it's like I was talking to Gil Kane, a fellow who drew one of the great film noir comic books. His name is Savage.
Mm-hmm.
And also drew Green Lantern, for a long stretch. I think Savage is largely forgotten today, but of course, Green Lantern, the John Broome, Gil Kane, Joe Giella stories, are considered classics, mm-hmm. and I find they don't hold up worth a darn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The art's good, but the art is uneven. Giella was not the right inker for Gil Kane, who needed, a tight, fluid inker instead of a stiff anchor, but the real problem is the stories. They're so nice. They're pandering to the censors. We better not let Green Lantern kill poor old Sinestro. We'll just have him put him, in a distant prison with a hypnotic ray on him. It's like, kill him!
Gil
Kane complained about that very thing when we visited the Dallas Cartoonist Convention, the Dallas Fantasy Fair.
The Dallas Fantasy Fairs, which is where you and I met way back when the Earth
was. Right, exactly.
Well, I'll tell you, let's talk a little bit about comic books. I want to talk about your series now, where this is going to come out just before Christmas, and what could make a better gift than comics from the gone world or forgotten horrors, comics, and stories.
Well, there sure enough have been a lot of them. We're working on volume two of Forgotten Horrors, Comics, and Stories right now.
Right.
And volume one is just out. The authorized comic book versions of two of the pictures that we've got in the fifth Forgotten Horrors movie book.
Destination Moon. And
Man from Planet X.
Mm-hmm.
But I hasten to add that these are tweaked versions with some really, really absurd new dialogue.
And I also should point out that the Tor Johnson Hollywood Star comic, which is being reprinted that I did with Bruce McCorkindale, is the only comic so far ever printed in AR Vision, alternate reality.
AR alternate, yeah.
Where you can read the real, more or less real story if you read every other page, or you can read the fanciful story. It's entirely up to you.
That Tor Johnson book, which of course touches on Yucca Flats, the darn thing went out of print so quickly that I guess it must have I guess it must be due any second now for a new edition, and so, well, here we are.
Well, and I thank you for it, too, because I'm very proud of it. It came along at the time, 91, you know, when the Independent, you and I both, of course, you with the Prowler and many other things, but the Prowler, a lot of people think very, very highly of, remember very fondly. And, you know, we all got hit at the same time in the early 90s. That black and white boom, somebody is going to come back, and it may be after we're long gone, but they're going to rediscover some of the really nice stuff that was done during the black and white boom in the mid to late 80s, I believe.
You know,
I don't want
black and white. The black and white comics of that period, well, of course, the opportunists seized on what they considered a craze,
right,
and just did it to death with a lot of hack work. But in the early stages, right up into late 80s, early 90s, there was a great deal of mature thinking and artistic vision that went into those indie comics.
I love the Fumetti on Son of Ngaji.
Oh, yeah.
That's very nicely done, and that's just a
big... Yeah, that's the legendary artist, Meatwood Flack.
Meatwood Flack, I know that's a Meatwood Flack product, and you know, Meatwood has really never been more precise with his dialogue, and his work is just very good in that. And, you know, it's just a nice, you know, people are looking for unusual gifts. And, you know, Comics from the Gone World, Forgotten Horrors 5, you know, that book's doing well, Michael.
It's doing very impressively, and you can find it at an Amazon.com near you.
And also, it's being sold by Oldies.com?
Oldies.com, yes.
All right, and of course, we plug this because, frankly, we're both involved in it, and we like to see that mailbox money coming in. And, tell the folks about, because I am a big, at the top of my list are the two comics from the Gone World collection that I don't have. About the best way to put it is that the dialogue is kind of a cross between vaudeville and Waiting for Godot. I think
well, it's certainly theater of the absurd.
It is. It's sartrified, as you...
The license to perpetrate existentialism,
yes,
is well enforced here.
You use that license pretty often in those.
I think my favorite of the series so far is called the Farkle-Schweiler Dossier.
Yes, that's the one that I got for Christmas last year.
I had many
laughs out of that. And of course, what you're taking is the latter Iger Studios artwork.
Yeah, we're taking those pre-censorship comics of the post-war 1950s.
Horror comics.
And restoring, tweaking, and above all, removing the bad writing and replacing it with absurd writing.
Right. That pretty much sums it up.
Sounds like a trade to me.
You know, you don't have a... I don't believe yet in this collection you have a cop in it that is not talking about donuts. No matter if there's zombies, whatever, that are ripping their arms off, they're talking about donuts. And it's just, it's that, plus it's just, it's the comedy. I can't recommend them highly enough. Now, I do have to plug my own work because I'm told by Bill Cunningham, who we call MPB, the Mad Pulp Bastard, who is my editor and publisher for a new collection of the Miracle Squad.
The Miracle Squad, yeah, one of my favorites.
Thank you, and they're taking pre-orders right now. It's set in 1930s Hollywood. It's really kind of that old joke, if it's a good picture, it's a miracle, which I think I first saw in Hollywood Boulevard by Arkush and Dante, that, you know, that they did for Roger Corman.
Sure.
And I think that was Miracle Studios. But it's Miracle Pictures. It's a bunch of B-picture. It's a little B-picture of a Poverty Row studio, and they get together and have some adventures. And there's about 50 pages of new stuff. I've actually, I'm Bill Cunningham, a very, very bright guy. And of course, Bill is a movie scripter as well. But Bill said, you know, how would you cast the Miracle Squad if you could cast them with 30s B-picture actors? And boy, what fun that was. And you helped me with a couple of pieces of art of guys that I was able to cast. And it's just some of that kind of stuff. So they're taking pre-orders on that right now, and that's from Pulp 2.0 Press. But you have to order it off the website, and pre-orders don't pay postage. And so that's coming up too. So we've got, if you want to give comics for Christmas, by golly, I see Joey's kind of dragging his thumb across his throat. So let's mention, yeah, I know it's not true, it's hyperbole. Let's mention our winner this week.
Yes, we do have a winner.
We need to figure out what we're going to give away next time, too, because we didn't really think about this. But our winner is Robert, and it's Valance. I don't know if that's Valance or Valance, like Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, Valance or Valance.
I figure we'll figure that out.
Yeah, well, we don't have to say it. We just have to write it down. You just have to write it down on the address that you're sending out the set of your cards, your trading cards.
Oh, the Hollywood Horrors trading cards. Yeah.
Going out to Robert Valance or Valance in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. I bet that's beautiful this time of the year. Yeah. What do we want to give away next week?
I've got this huge mint condition, never out of the wrapper file of the White Zombie comic book from 1989.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's give that away, and that's a mint condition, signed by you, I'm assuming.
Or naturally.
Yeah, that's signed by you, and the first person who writes us at my website, which is now under construction, but you can still get to it, it's www.johnwooley.com. All you have to do is write to that website and say, I'd like to get the Prowler White Zombie, as mentioned on the Forgotten Horrors podcast, and you'll be the winner. It's that easy. Any final thoughts on Tor Johnson and Beast from Yucca Flat?
I've tended to believe over the long haul that the only bad Tor Johnson is no Tor Johnson. This is probably the least of his performance in the Beast of Yucca Flats, and yet recognizably the fellow who commanded such impressive screen time Tor. And that nice soliloquy from Bela Lugosi basically justified the existence of Bride of the Monster.
The Monster, correct, yeah.
My favorite tour is an appearance on Groucho Marx's You Bet Your Life.
Well, now, I've not seen that.
It can be seen on YouTube, and I recommend it heartily.
Okay. Well,
you get to see him out of character, suit and tie, looking dignified as heck, and not quite knowing what to make of Groucho's pattern.
That's the sweetest name. Tor Johnson is the sweetest name.
Oh, Tor Johnson, you mean, huh?
Yes, sir.
I can't say Johnson. Just for the record, what's your gross tonnage?
It's about 387 pounds.
Is that strip for Jim?
That's soaking wet.
What are the rest of your dimensions, Tor? Personally, I'm not interested, but you... You may be an old boxcar that the Union Pacific Railroad is looking for.
My hips are 60, my stomach waistline is 54, and the chest is 62, my bicep is 22, and the neck is 20.
We have the same measurements. Yes, his chest and my automobile. Now, let me get this straight. You're 62, 54, 60?
That's right.
Well, I don't understand. With those measurements, you ought to be twice as attractive as Jane Mansfield. But for some peculiar reason, you're not. Not to me, anyhow.
Well, and you know, what was it that he said about visiting Forry Ackerman's house? You can't see the walls with all that crap? Wasn't that his line about Forry Ackerman? And the other thing is, I think there's an homage I would like to think these guys did an homage, that Coleman Francis and Anthony Cardoza did an homage to North by Northwest in that. I really do. I really want to feel that way. You know, and the other thing that's probably, you know, we talked about Anthony Cardoza was involved in some of the financing for Ed Wood's films, and you know, he was in that group kind of in the fringes. But one of the things that I remember out of Nightmare of Ecstasy, Rudolph Gray's book, that was the basis, of course, for the movie, was that They talked about when Ed Wood was in that hellhole apartment over on Yucca Street.
Oh, yeah.
They would always say, "Let's," when they wanted to go over and have and drink with Ed at that godforsaken place, they said, "Let's go to Yucca Flats."
Yes, let's go live like dogs.
I know. Let's go to Yucca Flats. And so,
very sad, actually, that whole scene, but by golly, they were trying to make art.
They were trying to make art, and I really would have liked to visit with those people. Now, I know that you visited with Ed Wood, and he was pretty far gone, but, you know, I have to say that there's a part of me who wanted to be one of Coleman Francis's kids doing that movie. That would have been the ultimate monster kid thing.
Randy! Art!
Just to be one.
That would have been, yeah. To have walked in the footsteps of fill in the blank. Well, I got to do my experience like that with William Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And a few others. I actually got behind the scenes at the world premiere of the Hideous Sun Demon.
Well, good for you.
And, you know, I was like, boy, that headpiece was stinky.
I know, you've got all that insider stuff, you know.
Exactly.
I got to hang out in John Carradine's makeup trailer.
Exactly, and to we both had nice encounters with Carradine,
that's right.
And got some material back then that we still use today.
That's exactly right. You know, and maybe this is a good place to sort of shut her down, but it reminds me of a Henry James quote, and I don't imagine Henry James and Anthony Cardoza have ever been mentioned in the same breath, but Henry James once said, "Be a person on whom nothing is wasted." And, you know, I think maybe what we're doing here, I mean, none of this is wasted. I mean,
and that brings right back full circle with Conan Doyle's observation that to those who truly love art, some of the worthiest examples can be found in the least honorable sectors.
That's exactly right. And also Conan Doyle put it in Sherlock Holmes's mouth that my whole life is spent in one long attempt to escape from the commonplace. Am I quoting that right? So there you go. Whatever else Tor Johnson's Beast of Yucca Flats is, it's not commonplace. But we want to know if people, you know, we would like to hear from you. If you want to hear us talk about a particular movie, if you think we need to talk about something else, or if you think we need to be off the air completely. I mean, we don't know. We'd be glad to hear from you, because chances are, if you're with us, we're pretty much hanging out. We would love to hear from you. So again, it's
and
the
we
same
would like
place.
To hear suggestions for content. What are you interested in?
Exactly. And we always like to hear from you. And if you want to, again, the web address, if you'd like to contact us, www.johnwoolley.com. This is the Forgotten Horrors Podcast. We want to thank you very much for listening. Michael, thank you. It's always great to visit.
You and me both, John. We'll be back for the next one.
All right. Thanks, Joey.